I want to start with a quote from Carl Jung. And it's simple, and it's also profound. Or at least it is to me. And that quote is this: until I make the unconscious conscious, it will direct my life and I will call it fate. I'm going to say it again. Until we make the unconscious conscious, it will direct our lives and we will call it fate. And so what on earth does that mean? And how does that relate to the conversation that we're in around pride? That's my intention today, is to explore that. And it's quite simple, actually. The alignment with New Thought principles is pretty simple, and that is there's only one power and one presence. And to know that, and to know that's who and what we are, that we're a perfect expression, a perfect emanation of that power, is then to know very deeply who we are here on planet Earth as a spiritual being, not having a human experience, which we often say, but a spiritual experience. I woke up one day and I heard the power of shifting from where human beings having a spiritual experience to spiritual beings having a human experience, and I kind of shot out of bed and thought, what if we're spiritual beings having a spiritual experience? Or as Michael Beckwith says, a spiritual incarnation. In other words, we are here as spirit on planet Earth. And if we have anything in the unconscious that hasn't been looked at and or addressed, it will be running the show, and we will think it's happening to us or that it is fate, instead of that we actually do create reality based on what? Right? Thank you, Unity students, who fell right into my little trap. So yes, it's true on one level that we create reality based on our thoughts. And when I walked into my first Unity community in 1988 or 89, I heard that and it blew my mind. What I want to explore is, in addition to that, there's actually something much deeper happening as well. And that is, we create reality based on our frequency and our vibration. And I want to share part of my personal journey, specifically how it relates to the month of Pride with LGBTQAI+. And I know there are more letters coming, and I appreciate that, and sometimes I have to keep up. I came into this world a very, very happy child. I actually remember being a pre-programmed human and mesmerized by life, lying in my backyard, looking at a blade of grass. I mean, literally, like, I felt like I could look at this for hours. How magnificent. A butterfly, ants. It all felt so magical, and I felt like the luckiest person to be here on this planet. Then I went to kindergarten. No, that's not true. That's not even my joke. That's my friend's. But the truth is, I had that experience of being wide open. I didn't have the words yet to say I'm a perfect emanation of the one power and the one presence. It was just innate. I was an effervescent little boy. Now, a small aside, Karen, is that my mom often says by the time I was 4, she realized I was going to probably grow up to be gay, and I look at my 3-year-old picture and show it to her and say, what took you so long? Because I am telling you, I was effervescent in Indiana in the 1960s. Oh, my goodness, right? Oh, my goodness. I walked out into the world and I realized very quickly a few things were being taught to me. Don't look like a girl, don't talk like a girl, don't walk like a girl, don't throw like a girl. I was like, well, what's wrong with being a girl? Let's start with that. But there was a very, very strong message of what it meant to be a little boy. And what I was supposed to do was play with my fire trucks instead of my dolls, and I would prefer the dolls. I was very fortunate in my household. Well, there are layers to this conversation. And since, you know, we're in the extroverted service, I'll share a little bit more about it. But I was very fortunate within my home that that wasn't an issue. I will, however, say that I also grew up in a household where everything looked really good on the outside. The four-bedroom house, the two cars, mom, stay-at-home mom, she was a product of the 1950s. I think had she been born 20 years later, she wouldn't have chosen to be a mother. One way I know this is she used to say to us, "I wish I hadn't chosen to be a mother." Thanks, Mom! And I now have a lot of compassion for her because she didn't think she had a different choice. So she married my dad. I've never said this out loud, so this will be a fun one to play with. I just took went on a cruise with my dad. There's a other story there. There's been a lot of healing. Gosh, this is being recorded. Okay, everyone, it's all right. One thing I love about this being recorded, though, is as I was sitting in the front row, I could see the back of my head and see that the Propecia is starting to work. So the bald spot's getting a little smaller. So that I'm grateful for. Starting to work. My dad told me that he knew he didn't love my mother and that the bishop of our church told him he would marry her. I didn't know this until a few weeks ago. But I can tell you and assure you that I felt it. So I grew up in a society that was not celebrating each of us as whole and perfect spiritual beings. I remember my grandfather, who I loved, saying overtly racist things. What do I do with that? We're going to talk more about that. I remember hearing the men in my sphere of influence and the way they talked about women in such a derogatory way that it hurt my soul. I remember turning on, well, I didn't even turn on the TV, there it was, the war, one of the wars was happening, and I remember feeling like I just couldn't stay open anymore. And at 7, I had a profound experience of closing my heart, and I recently, 12 years ago, when my nephew turned 7, I looked at him and I thought, oh my gosh, that is the age that I decided I was not lovable, I was not good enough, and the world was unsafe. And I shut down at that moment and started to believe that I was fundamentally broken, and so was the world. And I walked around that way, feeling damaged, feeling broken, and lo and behold, we all know this in Unity Principles, I just kept re-experiencing that over and over and over again because what was trapped in the unconscious was I'm not lovable. So I would walk into a room like this one, vibrating with I'm not lovable, and I would find one of you to confirm the core false belief that I'm unlovable. It doesn't even mean you're a bad human. It's just I chose you. And so what I really want to explore today in our individual journey and our collective journey, how we can heal the programming of the world so that we can return to the truth of who and what we are, not so that we can grow spiritually, because we're not here to grow spiritually. We are here to remember, recognize the essential truth of who and what we are. We came into the world as whole and perfect spiritual beings, and then we started believing we were broken. Byron Katie demonstrates this so beautifully. She says we're holding a projector, and there's a piece of lint on the lens, and we see the piece of lint everywhere, and we think it's happening in the world. And what we really need to do is simply clear the lens and remember who we are and be that in the world. And suddenly the world is transformed. And if you're anything like me, I'm going to take a drink of water on this one. My entire 20s was me trying to change the world so that I could be happy. And me trying to change the world so that I could be free. And the very first time I ever did a talk at a spiritual center, I think it was 2003, and it was titled Beyond Metaphysics. And it had come to me in a meditation that we were moving into an era of mysticism, of oneness, of a deeper awareness than the metaphysics that a lot of us had been taught. But what I want to say before I dive into this is that it's all perfect. Every stage of development is perfect. One is not better than the other. We wouldn't say to a 26-year-old, you should act like you're 63. We wouldn't say to an 80-year-old, you should act like you're 12, although sometimes it's fun, right? Sometimes it is fun. So these levels, and I'm going to give you a little sort of brief synopsis. So if your mind likes to have something to grab onto, this is something somewhat concrete, even though that's not usually how I am. So I created these four levels of consciousness, and I gave each of these levels an M for the title. And at the end of the talk, I'm going to come back and tell you what those are, but at the end of the talk, someone came up to me and said, have you ever heard Michael Beckwith speak? He has the same four levels. And I hadn't ever heard him. Obviously, I'd heard of him. So isn't that interesting, too, that we came to almost the exact same framework? And then I've talked with him about it now, and he said, yeah, and I picked it up from someone else and someone else and someone else. Not because we're copying someone, but because it's a truth that emerges. And it emerges in shared consciousness. So the four words that I use are martyr, magical thinking, metaphysical, and mystical. Martyr is the world happens to me. I'm a victim to the world. There's nothing I can do about it. The world is horrible. I lived there for a long time. There was something really fun about it, actually, because I didn't have to be accountable. I could blame my parents. I could blame society. I could blame the so-called other political party, even though today I understand that the other is an idea or a concept out of my human ego. We'll talk more about that. When we move into magical thinking, we move from the world happens to me to I make things happen. That's where we move into our mind and say, I can change my thinking, I can change my life. I'm not a victim to the world. I actually can affect the world based on my thinking. I call it magical thinking because I was part of a community in San Francisco, loosely. I was sort of on the periphery of it in the 90s. And they would say, oh, cancel, don't say that. The universe is going to get you. I mean, they literally would say that. And they had the rubber bands. Remember the rubber? Oh, don't say that. Shh. Oh, my gosh. And sometimes we come into new thought, like the air quotes, and we're just kind of repackaging some old thinking, right? Have you ever heard anyone say the cosmic 2x4? How is that different than a punishing God? Same idea, different outfit, right? And so when we move into metaphysical, we move into I allow things to happen. Things happen through me. This is where we start to move into our heart space. We're looking for a human connection, a connection of the heart. We would probably or possibly say, God lives within me in my heart. We're looking for connection from this place. And then we move into this next level of mysticism where we realize there's only oneness. And so are you ready to have a somewhat nuanced conversation about pride? And if you say no, I know how to work with that. Because I love questions, comments, and smart remarks. I do. When we're at the lowest level, and a lowest, again, it's not a judgment. It's just where we are and where we've been. A lot of the world lives in this victim martyr consciousness. I did, as I said, throughout my entire 20s, I lived there. I didn't want to be accountable for my life. I didn't actually think I could be accountable for my life because I thought it was happening to me. That's where blame lives, right? And so as a movement, as a pride movement, if we look at the progression, and by the way, let's have a moment of gratitude. As a little gay boy in Indiana, born in 1965, I said it out loud, I never imagined that today I would be married to a man. I never even fathomed that that would happen in our lifetime. So let's celebrate that. Let's celebrate that we are evolving, that consciousness is evolving. And so what I want to say, though, about this with the nuanced conversation is we might move into magical thinking, and that's where we think we have to fight for our rights. And it has a place. I want to be clear. It has a place. I see the fist out there, right? I see it. And that is something that it seems that, at least historically, has been needed for a movement to evolve. And then we start to realize many of us, that there's now a next level for us to move into the metaphysical and the mystical, where we honor the seeming differences and also realize that the ultimate reality is oneness. The ultimate reality is not our differences, but our oneness. And it doesn't mean I'm going to ignore the differences. Because what we call it now, we call it confirmation bias, which is just new thought saying we create our reality based on our point of view. Right? So if I believe the world is broken, I will see the world as broken, and I will find lots of evidence to support that. And so if I say the world is kind and loving, can I find evidence to support that? Are either one of them true or untrue? I heard a yes. Say more about that, just a little bit, more. They're both true and untrue. I love that. Yeah. In Unity teachings, we call it relative and ultimate reality. Relative reality is what we can see, touch, taste, feel. It's our five senses. It really kind of is that physical awareness of the world. And then we realize also a deeper reality. And that reality is oneness, that each of us is a perfect expression of this one power and one presence. And when I know that for me, I know that for you. And when I know that for you, I know that for me. And so what on earth do we do with what's happening on earth? Because sometimes people will say to me, well, we're living in these horrible times right now. And I say, have you looked at our history? Like, why do we think our times are so uniquely horrible right now? Because all of this has always been going on. The separation, the division, the love, the oneness, the connection, the loss, the gain. I don't know why we incarnated here. I don't know if we chose it. But I will tell you this. When I was a little kid, again, pre-programmed human, part of my lying in the backyard is I would look up and I would think, can you believe people say we're the only life in the universe? How arrogant is that? I mean, how is that even possible? Look at this. I mean, we're just like this little speck, right? I had that awareness, but I also had another awareness. And I don't know if it's true, but it feels true for me. And that is, I felt like we came to this planet to be love. That for whatever reason, because I had just learned about heaven and hell, and I was like, I'm not going to buy that. I couldn't buy it. I didn't get it. But what I did say is, oh, I wonder if we incarnate to different realms of existence and that we're on a somewhat low level with the war and the isms and the separation. And maybe some of us have chosen to be here to shift that consciousness. Now, you know, that might feel like a big and daunting task. The truth is, it's simple. Right here, right now, we know ultimate truth of who and what we are. We are now in a time where we are shifting from the law of attraction to the law of radiance. And new thought, Unity included, has its roots in some ways in this law of attraction, the manifesting. Let me create the life of my dreams. Let me manifest what I believe is going to make me happy. Right? And I was going to say I'm repeating myself, but that is the idea, right? I say the same thing in both services. Okay. So I was at this workshop once, and we were doing vision boards, which, by the way, are really visualization boards, because there is a profound difference between visualization and visioning. Visualization is, I decide what I want, I hold those thoughts, and then I manifest them. Visioning is, to the best of my ability, I move beyond any preconceived ideas about what I think is best for me in the world, and I listen intently to what one once called the still small voice, but we know it's neither still nor small. Because once I'm aware that the inner voice, that inner wisdom, is the power that will change the world, I realize that's so much better or more effective than anything I could create out of my mind. So I was in this workshop, it was probably 20 years ago, and I had a spontaneous insight. Stand up in front of the room with a blank vision board and say, my vision is to be open and receptive to inner wisdom. But I looked around, and everyone was putting the hot guy, the house, the car, the dollar signs, the stacks of cash. Uh-oh, I better do it right. So I abandoned that knowing for a moment and thought, oh, I better do all of this, because this is what we're doing here. And what I want to share with you, believe it or not, everything I put on that vision board manifested within a year. And I had a profound experience, and that experience was, now what? Is this all there is? I mean, I got a two-bedroom house with a view in San Francisco. We know how that's not easy to manifest, right? I got the hot partner. I got the Lexus. I got the business. All of it happened. And I still had this, there's got to be something more to life than that. And so what I want to say about that is the stuff doesn't make us happy. It also doesn't make us unhappy. So there's nothing right or wrong about the manifesting. The manifesting is fun. So much fun. And I love, you know, travel and nice clothes and all of that. It's great. There's a longing, though. This mystical longing is a longing to be truly connected with another human being from a space of oneness that is beyond anything I can manifest, and it becomes something that I get to radiate into the world. I get to be that love in the world. Jesus said, or was said to have said, be in the world, but not of the world. I don't think there's a more powerful statement that's ever been made. Be in the world, but not of the world. What does that mean? When I know who and what I truly am, that I am like you, like each of us is a perfect expression of love, perfect expression of the one power and one presence, that's all we need to do. Just be that in the world. Let me radiate that. And from that place, we understand that a life on purpose is so much better than a life of trying to get everything I think is going to make me happy. Like my umbilical cord is in my hands and I'm trying to get fed. Plug into some situation, a person, a place, more money, better job. And so as it comes to pride, and what I'm going to close with is say this, all of those stages have brought us to where we are today. And where we are today is at a profound moment of decision. And that decision is, who are we going to be now? What are the unconscious biases? If you think back to 2020, how everything emerged, and we were looking at race, and we were looking at gender, and we were looking at all these things, and we were being invited to look at our unconscious biases. But what I saw was this: you're over there, you're a racist. You over there, you're a misogynist. Right? Okay. I get it. And now what? Are we ready now to say, I loved my grandfather who implanted a lot of racist ideas into my psyche. And although I rejected it consciously, I absorbed some of that. And the deeper healing is for me to look at that, not from a place of judgment, but from a place of curiosity about what is required to be healed so that there can be more oneness on the planet, so that we can celebrate and honor as we do in pride, and in addition to that, there's a place beyond that. I mentioned that I went on a cruise with my dad and his wife, and they live in L.A., Lower Alabama. And I didn't even know that was a thing. It genuinely is. They say they're from L.A., right? So I live in L.A. now, and so we were like, oh, look, we're both from L.A. And as we started having some pretty honest conversations, we discovered something really not surprising at all. People from both L.A.s had a judgment about the other L.A. Isn't that shocking? I'm drinking on that one, too. I know I said I'm going to close with this. For those of you who know me, that means about 8 more minutes. So I am closing, though, because I see the clock. Judgment restricts. Curiosity expands. And a lot of times I hear people say, I want to find a like-minded community. And I want to invite the question, what does it create? I actually... This is just for me. It might not be true for you. I don't want to create a community of like-minded people because I tried to find people that agreed with me on everything. And I found some that agreed on a lot of things, but then, you know, things happen in the world, and I'm like, uh-oh, I don't agree with that tribe anymore with everything, and I might get thrown out. This is legitimately true, right? So I have to either pretend that I agree with you, or I have to change my thinking to acquiesce, because that, throughout history, has kept us safe, but now we're in a place of a profound possibility where we can actually have relationships with people who don't agree with us. Right? Because I'm not my thoughts. I have thoughts, but I'm not them. A lot of times, oh, you're saying that we're just going to meet in the middle. We're just going to agree to disagree. No, I'm saying that we can live beyond all of that. Let me actually be curious. I can sit down with my LA friends from Lower Alabama and ask them a lot of questions and notice if I have a reaction. Bessel van der Kolk, in his book, The Body Keeps the Score, says, trauma doesn't show up as a memory. It shows up as a reaction. And there are marginalized communities, including LGBTQAI folks, who have a collective trauma, and we can have a trauma response of wanting to protect or to fight. And I honor it, and I understand it, and I've lived it. And now we're in a place of deeper healing where we can understand that we can heal this because the greatest freedom, and I swear this is actually my last line, the greatest freedom we will ever experience is freedom from the reactive impulse. So we are here to be love and we are here to be light. So I want you to repeat after me. I am love.
I am love.
I am light.
I am light.
I am joy itself.
I am joy itself.
I am here to be the love.
I am here to be the love.
I am here to be the light.
I am here to be the light.
And I am here to be joy. And so it is. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you.